Hello and welcome to Sordid Cinema. This week we are going to discuss the new film Kong Skull Island, which is of course the latest entry into the long-running and temporally amorphous King Kong series of films. We'll also be discussing the series as a whole and what Kong may or may not represent. We're joined by special guest Thomas O'Connor.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hello and welcome to Sordid Cinema. My name is Simon Howell. Ricky D could not be with us this weekend, but I am joined by Mr. Patrick Murphy.
Hey, Simon. I am back. It is too bad that Rick couldn't get involved in this because I really wanted to talk some Kong with him, but you guys will do just fine.
C'est la life sometimes. We are, however, joined by Thomas O'Connor.
Hello. And considering the amount of Kong I've been watching recently, I'm glad I'm on this one. Because boy, do I have stories to tell.
That's great, because I have not had time to watch anything other than this new film. We may have occasion to discuss other films in the series, but I think we will be relying on your expertise rather heavily.
Fair.
Before we get into Skull Island and the rest of the Kong series, I just wanted to say do check out GoombaStomp.com and its associated film content area / site, Sordid Cinema. And what's been going on in the GoombaStomp realm? I mean, I know that everyone's goddamn obsessed with Zelda. Is there anything else worth mentioning?
They are obsessed with Zelda. But, we've got Thomas has written a four-part series, I believe, Tom, on King Kong, all the King Kong movies.
Yep, every
live-action
one.
Totally worth checking out. I had to proof all those, so I am very familiar with them. They're excellent articles. I highly suggest any fans of Kong read those. Those are fairly new.
So, Thomas, where in the timeline does Mighty Joe Young fall?
I actually haven't watched Mighty Joe Young yet. At one point, I considered watching all of the King Kong knockoff movies, like Mighty Joe Young. There's one from Britain in, I think, the 70s called Ape.P.E. I think there's at least a couple of Chinese ones, but by the time I finished watching all the proper ones, I was just like, I need a break. I can't do this anymore. No more monkey movies.
Right.
I'm done.
To say nothing of Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other kettle of apes.
Yeah. Yep. It's really big right now, too. That's like two ape movies. Because when is the new ape movie or Planet of the Apes coming out? Like later this year?
The new one's called Planet for the Struggle for the filibuster of the War of the Planet of the
War
Apes.
War for the adjectives, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God. How much longer can they make those titles? And how many more, like, completely new actors can they get to be the human lead? It went from was it James Franco
was the first one, yeah.
James Franco
Russell.
Woody Harrelson. Last one, it was Gary Oldman, too.
And Gary Oldman, yeah.
Yeah, he was in there. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's just a revolving door of people going through that series.
War for the Planet of the Character Actors.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
All right, so we may as well get into it, I've got to interrogate you on the history of Kong. So let's do it. Let's start talking about Kong Skull Island and the Kong series. Let's hear a clip from the new film by Jordan Vogt Roberts.
An uncharted island.
Let me list all the ways you're gonna die. Rain, heat, disease-carrying flies, and we haven't started on the things that want to eat you alive.
We'll double that.
Plus a bonus if we make it back.
If?
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine.
Is that a monkey?
Get the hell out of here!
blood on the island.
We don't belong here.
But the devils live below us. I call them skull crawlers.
Why?
Because it sounds neat.
Okay.
Look, I just made that name up. I'm trying to scare you.
I'm fine calling them that. Are you cool with it?
Yeah, that seems like
a good name. I like the name.
That was a clip from Kong, Skull Island, directed by Jordan Vogt Roberts and written by Dan Gilroy, Max Borenstein, and Derek Connolly. And it's got an ensemble cast, Tom Hiddleston, Samuel L. Jackson, John Goodman, Brie Larson, recent-ish Best Actress winner, worth mentioning, Jing Chan, Toby Kebbell, John Ortiz, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So many people. And, of course, John C. Reilly, who we will have occasion to talk about, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Interestingly.
Very small cameo by Richard Jenkins in that, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Because apparently he's just gone back to doing cameos.
Yeah, and
He had his year of being, like, a leading man, and now he's just back to being that guy.
Yeah, that guy. Shea Whigham, also notably in the cast for any Eastbound and Down or Boardwalk Empire fans. Anyway, so this one takes place just after the end of the Vietnam conflict, and essentially John Goodman leads a scientific expedition with a military convoy to check out Skull Island, where he believes that he may find something of interest. And of course they do. They find Senor Kong, who turns out to be the defender of this island against a set of creatures referred to as skull crawlers, etc., etc. There's a lot going on. We'll get there. I guess I may as well start with you, Thomas, since you've just bit so many bullets by talking with us on the site about the history of Kong. So, I mean, what do you feel like Skull Island adds to the lore of Kong?
Well, it's kind of tricky to say because it's not really concerned with a lot of the previous films in terms of emulating them, besides the basic setup of there's an island, there's a big ape, he fights some stuff. It's really more there to set up future movies than it is to homage the past, because it's going to set up King Kong versus Godzilla and then presumably whatever they do after that. So there are little nods here and there to previous films, but for the most part, it's really its own beast, I think.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah, like there's little hints here and there, you know, like it's this weird running joke that in every movie, Kong will like break something's jaw. So that's in there. But aside from that, it's interesting that this is the only Kong movie ever done where he's on the island the whole time and there's no Empire State Building kind of deal. There's no him getting shot down by planes at the end. It's really on its own kind of wavelength, which makes it stand out, I think. But also, yeah, it sort of starts the whole cycle new.
Right. Patrick, do I recall correctly that you're a huge fan of this movie?
If you read my review, you will note that I am a big fan of this movie. Not that I'm going to call it like a great movie, you know, for real lovers of fine cinema, but for people who like Sci-Fi Channel monster movies, and I count myself as one of those, this is what I've always wanted to see on the Sci-Fi Channel, is a really good Sci-Fi Channel monster movie. And that's what I would say that Kong Skull Island is. It's basically a giant wank off, but in the best way possible. everything's so over the top and so sensationalized. Like, even the cinema, like, the shot compositions are ridiculous in this. Everything is. And I love that. I love that the actors play it fairly straight for the most part. I think there are a couple of roles, and we can get into that later, where they sort of venture into, I don't know, farce in a little bit. But they seem to be more self-aware than the others. But for the most part, the actors play it straight, and the movie just, it's like sarcastic filmmaking, really. Mm-hmm. It's not done. It's not self-aware with the dialogue as much as with the filmmaking itself.
Right.
And I kind of really liked that. It really, for me, it was a very, very fun movie. Very light popcorn, you know, cotton candy movie.
Right. It is interesting, now that you mention it, that the original title of this film was Kong Wankoff Island.
Very different movie in the pre-production stages.
Yeah, yeah.
They brought the rating way down to make sure they got the mass market. Yeah.
Better stay under the canopy if that happens.
So
you're gonna.
I have to recount my story of watching this film, which is roughly 40 minutes in. There's a sequence of the characters making their way through a thick jungle underbrush. There's a lot of scenes like that, but one scene in particular. And I remember this scene in particular because in the middle of the scene, my mother came on screen, and that's when I realized that I was no longer awake. And it wasn't my fault, and it wasn't the movie's fault either. It's because I'd had a long fucking St. Patrick's Day the previous night, and I went to see it on Saturday afternoon, and I was fading by the middle. It was not because the movie was boring, but I do feel the need to say that I cannot accurately assess this movie in any serious way, because there is a 15 to 20 minute segment of it that I was not fully conscious for, unless my mother really was in it, which I don't think.
I don't think so.
I don't think
so.
I think you would have noticed.
But I could say, yeah, probably not.
So
unless your mom looks like Brie Larson, I don't know.
No, not recently. Anyway, but that being said, that is the asterisk caveat on everything that I have to say about this movie. So keep that in mind going forward. But I will say that I enjoyed it. It has a fun sort of Vogt Roberts brings this tone to it that is, I think, the right amount of flippant. And you said sarcastic, Patrick. I think that's about right. It feels like he brings a lightness and a deftness to it that I wasn't really expecting. There's also this sort of satirical dimension that we can't ignore. I mean, it's there from the very first line of the movie, wherein John Goodman gets out of a cab in D.C.
Oh yeah,
and says there'll never be a. I'm ad-libbing here, but like. I'm paraphrasing, but mark my words, there'll never be a time this screwed up in Washington again, or something like that. And again, this movie is set in 1974 or something.
When they pulled out of Vietnam. Yeah.
This movie is very actively engaging in that kind of tone. And I think it's very much, and I want to credit Dan Gilroy for that, just based on the stuff that he's done in other films. But who knows really for sure. But the movie is actively engaging in that kind of dialogue. And it's there, especially in shots like the Nixon bobblehead frantically going from side to side as the helicopter crashes. And
the sandwich. I mean, the editing in this is also very, very, very self-aware, in on the joke kind of thing.
And I'm only going to do this once, I promise, because I don't want to be the guy who's always talking politics on the podcast about the silly movies. However, I do find it interesting that in this movie, King Kong is a commie. Because, and I say this because, he is there pretty explicitly protecting what is pretty explicitly a commune where no one owns anything and everything sort of, which, you know, as a movie that's taking place in the wake of Vietnam, it's kind of hard.
I hadn't made that connection, but you're definitely right.
It's kind of hard not to think of this as a movie about, you know, the folly of American foreign adventures. But I'm not going to beat that drum too much over the course of the hour, because I know that's going to be really sickening to everyone.
Well, that's kind of a Vietnam War movie theme, you know, for one thing. I mean, the folly of, you know, America taking its military into places it doesn't belong is definitely, you know, a Vietnam movie.
Right. And we should probably talk about, you know, the Samuel L. Jackson character and his bloodlust for, you know, him sort of having, you know, blue balls at the end of Vietnam and feeling like it all happened for nothing, which, you know, someone in that position may very well feel that way. And then him feeling like bringing the war to Kong is sort of his redemption, which is a really, to be honest, I think is a really smart angle to take with this film. And but then having the sort of indigenous people of Skull Island exist in this sort of communal fashion is a really sort of savvy way to tie in with that, I think.
Yeah, you smell that? That's death.
What the hell is this place?
This is what's left of Kong's parents.
I've taken enough photos of mass graves to recognize one.
The crash site's just on the other side of this valley.
We'll cross through and make it to the highest point west.
This place is a real no-no, sir.
We need to be going to the north side right now.
And you're welcome to do that, my man. By yourself. I'm not leaving Jack out there. Now, who's with me?
We can make it.
You're mighty right we can make it.
Now, stay sharp. Keep an eye out.
I've only been here 28 years. What do I know?
I kind of got the vibe that this was sort of Apocalypse Kong.
A little bit, yeah.
And that Samuel Jackson was sort of going full on, you know, Colonel Kurtz on us.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess something I want to ask you, Thomas, since you've done the, and I'm literally saluting to you right now. You can't see it, but I am. You've done the due diligence of watching every single live action Kong film. Is like what I always find, you know, Godzilla represents something very specific. And the movies make it pretty explicit. You know, he represents, you know, nuclear annihilation and and, you know, the dangers of nuclear proliferation and the folly of the military industrial complex, et cetera, et cetera. But I feel like Kong, metaphorically speaking, is a little bit more amorphous and open to interpretation. So I'm wondering how you feel about what Kong represents, maybe in this movie versus some of the other movies you watched.
Well, it's tricky. I think that that angle you were talking about of, you know, military intervention by the United States, it's definitely there. And that's a new angle that they haven't really attacked Kong from yet up until now. Previously, like, for example, in the 70s movie, he's taken off the island as part of a marketing campaign for a gas company. So, you know, there's this big commentary about consumerism and the gas crisis was going on at the time, so that was a big hot button issue. A lot of people have also ascribed it as being, or described it rather, as a racial metaphor, which I think works to a degree, but maybe not as well as some people would like. The Japanese movies didn't really bother with any kind of subtext, aside from, again, a slight jab at marketing culture. The 80s one, I don't know if we want to talk about that one.
Oh,
but
please do. You watched it. You should talk about it.
I did. The 80s Kong movie, which a lot of people don't even know exists.
I didn't.
It's a sort of sequel to the 70s movie, where it turns out that he survived falling off the Empire State Building. Or actually, no, it was in the 70s film, he falls off the Twin Towers, which is very uncomfortable to watch. Let me tell you. Yeah, it's... with the benefit of hindsight, it's a very awkward sequence. They did a sequel like 10 years later where he's been in a coma this entire time at a university medical center. And no kidding. And Linda Hamilton is the attending physician, and they have to give him an artificial heart. And in order to do that, they need to find another to give him a blood transfusion. And wouldn't you know it, they find a Lady Kong.
Wow.
And a female King Kong who they cart in to be his blood donor. And then the Kong wakes up and they run away and go on the lam. It's a very strange, amorphous film that doesn't really have a point. It's just kind of there.
You know, it's funny because most people don't even remember the 70s one. And then you tell them, oh, yeah, there's one in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, well, I think the reason the 70s one is even interesting to talk about is because of how troubled the production was, because it was very, very ambitious for the time, and they put a lot of money into it, and it made its money back in the end. But then a couple of months later, some movie came out, Star Wars, something like that, Star Conflict, I don't know, it's some lesser-known sci-fi movie.
I've never heard of it.
Star Scrapes.
Yeah. And for some reason, that took all of the attention off, and Kong sort of had to, like, slink away into the shadows because it had been completely completely outdone by that.
Oh, for the time when you could only have one blockbuster franchise at a time.
Yeah, pretty much. People just had short attention spans back then.
I think we remember because it had Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange, too, who, of course, you know, went on to do many other great things. And it's a guy in a monkey suit. I mean, you can't forget that. Once you've seen it, you can't unsee that in today's age.
Not even that terrible a costume, I think, if you, you know, consider everything. The problem with that, I think, is that they just shot it and lit it in really unambiguous ways. Like, there's no attempt to hide it or, you know, play it coy with the fact that it's a guy in a monkey suit. It's just there, center screen, brightly lit. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's, there's no getting around it. That's Rick Baker in a monkey suit. Yep. Okay.
Oh, was Rick Baker? I didn't know that.
It was Rick Baker. Yeah, that was like one of his break-ins into the industry. Was he was the one of the effects assistants on the movie, and they were like, "No one is going to agree to be in this suit. Get that new kid to do it." Mm-hmm. And yeah, they piled him into that suit, and he apparently like spent a month and a half just sweating himself to death.
Did it make you cry though, Thomas? Mm-hmm. Did it make you cry?
Not really. It's certainly hammering on the melodrama button, like real hard, which is, I think, what they what sets that movie apart from the original. Is in the first one, they didn't really play up the tragedy of, you know, him being brought over and killed and all that. In the 70s one, oh boy, do they go overboard on it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Huh. Like
I love that. You quoted in your write up of it the producer Dino De Laurentiis, who specifically said he was going to make people cry with this one.
Yep, at the end of Jaws, people don't cry for the shark, but at the end of our movie, they'll cry for the monkey.
Well, this is actually something that I appreciated about Skull Island, is that there's not a lot of histrionics in it in any particular direction. And I, at least not, maybe I missed something in the 20 minutes I was asleep with my mother for, but there's no, like, even the, you know, they could have very easily thrown in like a heavy-handed love story between Tom Hiddleston and Bill
Larson.
Yeah, there's
none. There's no love story at all, which I always find very refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely like some flirtatiousness and some suggestive body language and stuff like that, and they make sure to put Brie Larson in like the tightest tank top possible you know, the majority of the film. But, and you know, there are multiple possible pairings in the movie that they don't really explore. And they could have easily padded it out with an extra 35 minutes to do all this stuff. And I, you know, it's a small thing, but I appreciate that restraint.
Yeah, no, me too.
I also like that they didn't really go for the traditional storyline of, you know, the Faye Ray or Jessica Lange, you know, component where there's the, you know, woman who feels, you know, some sort of kinship with Kong and Kong likes her. And then that the story kind of revolves around that, and that's usually where you're supposed to feel some emotion in those movies. There's a little bit of that in this, like, and it comes out a little bit at the end, but that has more to do with just Kong recognizing two people that treat others right.
Right, yeah, that have some empathy for non-human creatures.
Exactly.
Was that being said, was anyone else kind of hoping they'd have the chutzpah to... After the sequence where Kong has Brie Larson in his hand and like shoves it down the main skull crawler's throat, that he'd like open his palm and Brie Larson would just be like little Brie Larson bits crushed in his
just
palm.
A red paste. Yeah, no, he must have really soft hands if she survived that, because like she was fine. She was completely fine. Not a bruise on her. Yeah.
She was the one character that I didn't think belonged in this movie, period. It's like they basically needed a female lead, and so they invented this anti-war photographer to go in there, but she served ultimately no purpose. Why she was going along on this expedition made absolutely no sense. I know they had the whole Pulitzer thing, but she didn't know they were going to find anything there. For all she knew, it was a geological survey. Like, this would have been the most boring shoot ever. They didn't even know there were any natives there.
Right. Well, I mean... I think she's there to help serve the purpose of the conscientious objector, because otherwise, you know, you've got a bunch of scientists who are apolitical, and you've got, you know, military goons, and you kind of need someone there to help stand in for the people who objected to all this from the beginning. And I think that's fair. Whether she serves as a plot or theme device as opposed to a fully fledged character. I think that's fair, but I think that's also kind of true of every character in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, is Samuel L. Jackson like really a fully fledged person? Not really. He's mostly just there to like call the monkey a motherfucker and like try to kill it. That's pretty much it.
Characters are nothing. They're just as stylized as the rest of the film.
Absolutely.
Like, they're just as over the top and cartoonish as a shot of Kong against a giant sunset as helicopters come towards
them. Yeah, and I think that's fine. I think that's totally fine for what Vogt Roberts is going for.
I think the only ones who are really disposable, and you know, you can tell that because the movie disposes of them, is the two blue jacket guys. Do you remember them? The one guy gets yanked off the boat. And the other guy who's, I only recognize him from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where he has a recurring guest role. He's the guy who looks like Agent Coulson from the Marvel movies.
Mark Evan Jackson, yeah.
Yes, exactly, him.
Mark Evan Jackson plays every douchebag on every sitcom you've ever watched.
Every really stuffy guy, yeah, who speaks really monotone and is very prim and proper.
Yeah.
The movie kept cutting back to those two, like, in particular, like, oh, these guys, you're supposed to care about these guys. And it's like, are we really? Because you've given me no reason to whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason, as it turns out, the only reason they're calling attention to people is so that we can enjoy their surprisingly gory deaths.
Yeah.
Maybe this is something else we can talk about. Like, I find it fascinating what you can and cannot get away with what I assume was a PG-13 rating. Because
it's a PG-13, yeah.
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 And they push that to the absolute limit. Like, there are multiple F-bombs. There's at least one F-bomb.
There's at least a couple.
And one S-bomb. And I was noticing these things. And characters get limbs ripped off.
Oh, yeah. When the guy gets snatched off the boat was really brutal.
Yeah, and I was impressed at the and they're also like, Vogt Roberts like obviously edited, you know, they obviously I feel like they must have had a back and forth with the MPAA to see exactly what they could get away with for the rating.
Yeah,
because there are sequences where it seems like in particular there's a sequence where a character lands on top of a helicopter and they slowly like end up getting like chopped up by the blades, and it seems like the screen gets doused in blood, but it's so fast that it's hard to know if it was just a lens flare or something.
No, it definitely got doused in blood. I remember that. That was great. They're definitely getting away with a little more here. Although when you think about it, you know, the MPAA has gone through all sorts of, it's a pendulum, man, and it seems to be swinging back the other way. I mean, Indiana Jones, you know, Temple of Doom got away with ripping somebody's heart out in PG.
Well, that was the movie that ended up inspiring PG-13, but this movie actually feels like one of those pre-PG-13 PG movies where they got away with sort of stylized violence.
You know, in back in the day, you could get away with violence in G. I mean, Ben-Hur's Chariot Race is fairly violent, and that was a G-rated movie. I don't know. They're definitely getting away with more than most other movies. The amount of blood in this movie is pretty impressive, but maybe it's because of the cartoonish tone. See, that's the other thing. The MPAA often goes for, you know, how serious, how grisly is this kind of stuff. This is a big cartoon, essentially.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I watched it right after Logan, so it felt like a step down in terms of gore from that. But still definitely in the upper edges of PG-13.
And it needed it. Like, those are the punctuations that make this movie really lively. The action in this movie is what makes it. Because the characters, all of them are basically useless. Except for the Samuel L. Jackson and the John C. Reilly character. Those are the two most entertaining ones. Because they're really, really hamming it up.
Yeah.
Like, Tom Hiddleston could have been played by any actor across the board. Just get male, you know, decent looking male actor.
Yeah, can we get a white man who's reasonably built? And it was not something that really, like, Hiddleston's a fine actor, he's done good work in lots of things, but you're right, he absolutely could have been anybody. We need to talk about John C. Reilly, because I think without him, in many ways, the movie wouldn't work.
Very much so. I think he's one of the few people, and I'll say Samuel Jackson as well, who knows what kind of movie he's in, and he plays it accordingly.
Yeah.
He's not being, he's not mocking his own character or anything like that. He's not being too self-aware. He's kind of the, for any Treasure Island fans out there, he's sort of the Ben Gunn of this movie. Mm-hmm. He's this crazy guy who's been marooned on this island. Well, he's crazy because he's been marooned on this island for so many years, decades. And he's just, everything about him is odd. His line readings are all odd. This is...
Yeah. He'll this just have definitely... a weird inflection here and there, and he'll be like, oh, that's a little strange.
The one thing I kind of resented about the film and his character that I do need to criticize it for is the need to, like, tack on this heartwarming element to his character where he's got this family back home where he's trying to get back to them, and you see an, eventually in the credit sequence that he does. And honestly, I think it would have been a more satisfying movie if maybe he, whether or not he has a family back home, where he's just like, nah, this is my place now, man. Like... this is just, this is, you know, this is it for me. And he's gone too far to the other side to ever go back. Like that to me would have been a more entertaining character choice. But then you wouldn't have been able to have the heartwarming element, which I guess they were going for.
Well, the heartwarming thing was kind of ridiculous. I'm not sure why they chose to close the movie on him, because it's not like he was the entire movie revolved around him. Yes, he's there from the beginning, but the movie didn't really, I mean, Kong was kind of the center of this universe. It wasn't anybody else. They flit back and forth between all the characters pretty evenly. But I do like the interchange with him, you know, saying he's had a wife, maybe, and he's got a kid, and characters telling him basically like, well, you know, they left you. They already think you're dead. Don't worry about it.
Shea Whigham is great for scenes like that, I should mention.
Just
that was
deadpan,
good for the dialogue. I liked those exchanges. Yeah. I liked how he had hope back there, but they're telling him, nah, there's nothing for you back there.
Yeah.
What would have been really probably too dark for this movie is if they go through all the thing where he gets back and he gets back to his family, and then it's like, oh wait, I have really bad PTSD right now because I've just been through some serious stuff and I can't really tell anyone about it because I'm probably under government orders not to, and they'll think I'm crazy.
Right.
So,
like, he gets back to his house, and his wife and son both have skull crawler faces. That would have been an ending. I'll tell you what.
Twilight Zone.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
But yeah, I that dimension of the movie didn't really work for me. But I don't know. That's probably pushing it more in a cynical / funny direction than Vote Roberts really was. It was allowed to / probably even wanted to do so. I'm committing that cardinal sin of wishing for a different movie than the one we got. So I'm just acknowledging that. I do want to specifically spotlight, since I mentioned him, Shea Whigham, who is a great character actor I've loved in many things, and he gets some of the you mentioned his deadpan delivery, and he's so great in this, and I have to specifically give a shout out to his final scene. Which I could not have predicted how that went.
It was fantastic. It was absolutely fantastic.
So mean-spirited, but at the same time, you just can't help but laugh at it because it's just like, oh, the big sacrifice. Nope. You get nothing. You get, like, tail-slapped into a cliff.
Yeah, and I liked that scene both because it was fucking hilarious and mean and like, surprisingly mean-spirited. But also, like, on a thematic level, I hate to keep going back to this well, but I think it's kind of great that you...
thinking you're
going to
be the big hero, and it's just not the case.
Yeah, well, yeah, this idea that you're gonna go out in a blaze of glory in this strange foreign conflict that really doesn't mean anything, I think actually connects quite well to the Vietnam stuff and to the Samuel L. Jackson character, and... It was a genuinely unexpected moment in a movie that doesn't really have like a lot of the, and a movie that sort of delights in not having a lot of those because it's so programmed to give you sort of prescribed thrills, which it does reasonably well. And then to have moments like that really that genuinely cut against expectation, it has just enough of those to be sort of earnestly surprising.
Yeah, well, I think those prescribed thrills, I think, are really the key to this film's success, because for me, at least, it feels very much like a response to the last Godzilla movie and probably to a lesser extent, the last Japanese Godzilla movie. Did either of you guys see that one?
I have not.
Godzilla.
Not the Japanese one. No.
I mean, I know that it was made by the Neon Genesis Evangelion guys, so I assume it's at least a little bit perverse.
not perverse so much as really fanboyish, but rather than fanboyish for like Godzilla, it's fanboyish for Japanese political bureaucracy.
That sounds perfect.
I'm not even joking.
That sounds like literally the exact movie I would have expected from that guy. This is a guy who, every time he reboots Neon Genesis Evangelion, he gets more money to make it and he makes it less accessible. So that's not surprising to me.
Yeah, like for every 5 minutes of monster action in his Godzilla movie, there's maybe 20 minutes of boardroom.
Perfect.
And the logistics of crisis management, which is interesting, but totally not what I'm there for. And it's the same thing as in the last American Godzilla, the 2014 one, where it's like every time something cool is going to happen, it's like, oh, no, you don't want to see that. That's not what we're here for. We have to see this kid watching it on TV or have the doors close on it. And this feels like it's on completely the other end of the spectrum where it's like you're here to watch giant monsters fight. Let's just get to it, you know?
Right, yeah. You see a lot of Kong in this movie, and it doesn't take very long either.
No, they hit the ground running and basically never stop. And I really appreciate it for that.
Absolutely. That's one of its chief positives here. That from the very first helicopter sequence, which was a fantastic sequence. Just expertly done. Just such great editing in that whole sequence.
Yeah.
But they don't go with the whole awe of Kong kind of thing. And I like that. They didn't get into the whole awe of the special effects, right? Because Kong for a long time has always represented this like, oh, look what we can do. We can make this giant ape. And that worked in the 1933 movie because audiences were shocked that they could do special effects like that. But nobody cares anymore. Everybody's seen giant apes now. So let's forget that whole premise. Let's forget this awe of Kong and let's just throw them right into the mix and have them start doing a bunch of cool stuff.
And
that's what this movie does. It is shallow as hell, but it is a bunch of cool Kong action.
Right.
Yep.
And then little bits of comedy in between.
I mean, I'm not sure how shallow it is, really. I do think that they're, you know, they've chosen the Vietnam setting and they've chosen, like, several aspects of how the movie was written and designed for a reason. But I think I kind of agree with you in the sense that they have chosen specifically to background those elements and to not have, you know, they have characters debating the rights and wrongs of Vietnam a little bit in the first act, but they don't foreground any of that stuff in a way that anyone could possibly find hectoring, I think is perfectly fine. I do also find it interesting that, you know, you were talking about the special effects and what people are used to and what they won't be wowed by anymore. And, you know, the contemporary Planet of the Apes movies have done such a fantastic job of sort of humanizing apes and giving, you know, the Caesar character in the Apes movies is more emotive than the human characters, and they've done that on purpose, and like they've really elevated that particular special effect to this new level, and they don't even really try to do that with this. I mean, this Kong is a little bit emotive, and he does have moments that are somewhat Caesar-like. But they don't try to compete with that level of emotiveness with Kong. He is more of a, you know, he's a defense mechanism for this island, and he recognizes compassion, but he's not an emotionally complex character. And I'm glad that they didn't try to do too much with him.
Yeah, whatever emotion he has is basically relayed through some expositionary dialogue, and that's pretty much it. It's pretty short and pretty sweet. Like it they don't really get into it. They don't try to make Kong too much of a character. Like you said, he's just a defense mechanism on this island. It's like he's been triggered, you know, their bombing has awoken the security system and that's it. And that's great because it didn't need to be about that. I got kind of sick of the self-serious Kongs. Didn't need to see that anymore. I'm not saying they can't go back to that well ever again, but this kind of cleansed the palate for me as far as King Kong movies go.
They're totally like going back to that well, I promise. Yeah. Thomas, how did you feel about the characterization of Kong over the movies? How does this rank in terms of like making Kong a character?
Well, it's tricky because in the previous instances where they've tried to make Kong a character, it's kind of backfired because, like, for example, in the 70s movie, they're really, really playing up the tragicness and trying to make him more sympathetic. And the way they do that is just shot after shot of him grinning at
Jessica Lange.
At Jessica Lange, thank you, with this big, dopey, gormless grin on his face. And they're trying to tug at your heartstrings by having him just constantly go, and it just does not work because he just comes across as this big dope. And like you said, in this, they don't really bother with trying to make him sympathetic or interesting beyond, you know, as this sort of monolithic figure. And I think because of that, it's kind of more successful.
Well, and
they didn't give him any weird personality traits either, like the original one had, you know, where he sort of like picks at Fay Wray and then he smells his fingers.
Or like when he would kill something, he'll usually play with the corpse afterwards. Like he'll kill a T-Rex and then be like working its jaw, like, I'm dead now.
How does a hinge work? He's figuring things out. He is a monkey.
Yep,
it's true. He's got tools that he can use.
Right. Although in this movie, it seems like he's so used to killing these things that he's not really like, he's gotten over the toying phase. He's like, oh, there's another one. Mm-hmm. Except, you know, this one's bigger than the other one. That's pretty much it. Oh, as long as we're talking about creatures in this movie, I am glad that I woke up from my stupor in time for the spider sequence, which was...
That was a pretty good sequence.
That was... another thing that I cannot believe they got away with was
the impaling?
The spider leg in the mouth. Oh, my God.
Man.
That was almost so Cronenbergian.
Yep.
There were a lot of juices in that scene, you're right.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Everyone's getting sprayed with spider guts. Yeah, that was a really, again, a more inventive sequence than I was really expecting out of this. And it seemed like some combination of the screenwriters actually took some time to think, okay, if creatures had evolved in this sort of isolated space and they were looking to become, you know, apex predators, how might they evolve? Oh, well, maybe spiders would grow bamboo-like legs in like bamboo thick areas to like try to off, you know, unsuspecting mammals, which is like, you know, I'm already thinking about this more now than I was when I was watching it, but it's kind of cool when stuff happens in a movie like this and it actually makes a sort of intuitive sense.
Yeah. It fosters a sense that this is an ecosystem rather than just a collection of random monster designs that they slap together.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really know if the giant water buffalo was really, really fit in there, but I'll take it.
I really like that part, actually. The Vogt Roberts has talked a lot about how a lot of his inspiration for the creatures and the visuals was actually Princess Mononoke.
And I can see that.
Totally see that. Yeah, right? Especially with the water buffalo bit and this sort of kind of mythological sense to a lot of it. I watching that sequence in particular, I could really feel that influence.
You are going to tell me everything I don't know, or I'm going to blow your head off.
Monsters exist. Yesterday I was a crackpot, but today
you dropped those charges to flush something out.
Who are you? Ancient species owned this earth long before mankind, and if we keep our heads buried in the sand, they will take it back. My agency is known as Monarch. We specialize in the hunt for massive unidentified terrestrial organisms.
You knew that thing was out here?
I'm sorry for your men, Colonel. I truly am. Get us home with proof so we can send the cavalry.
Anything else about the creature design stand out to you, Patrick?
No, I'm just second. What do you guys say? I like the phasmid that they kind of had. It looked like it was like a bug type thing that looked like a log, wasn't it? I don't know what that thing was.
Yeah.
I will say the main bad creatures, though, the skull crawlers, as John C. Reilly calls them,
a little underwhelming.
They totally were. And I find that in movies like this, and I know this is, you know, part of the whole Godzilla, this is going to be their new Monsterverse, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't find the monsters in Godzilla, the 2014 Godzilla, to be all that appealing or memorable either. In fact, I still can't remember what they look like. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm going to remember what the skull crawlers look like either.
Yeah.
Not having legs was kind of interesting, or not having four legs, I should say, was kind of interesting. But other than that, they were just generic dinosaur-like things. They didn't really have any personality. Whereas I will probably remember the water buffalo and the spider for sure.
I
those are big be interesting.
And again, if this is something I missed in my stupor, I apologize, but one of my favorite line readings of the movie was John C. Reilly talking about the giant ants that sound like birds. He's like, you think they're ants? Sorry, you think they're birds? Nah, they're fucking ants. And it was, I'm so glad they were able to sneak that particular F-bomb in there because it was so effective. But if I recall correctly, we never actually saw them.
No, which sort of leads you to think, like, there could be giant ants that sound like birds. He also could be kind of nuts right now.
Yeah.
And you never get a solid answer on that, so it's just a nice little aside.
Yeah, I really appreciated that. I would have appreciated, I probably would have appreciated it just as much if, like, near the end, I don't know, like, one of the other tertiary characters was nabbed by a giant ant that sounded like, that made a bird sound right in our faces. But
I was trying to figure out if that was a reference to them, because remember in that movie the ants make this weird sort of bird like cry, almost this very distinctive sound effect, and the whole time I was just like, was that a them reference or not? I don't know.
Hard to tell if you're reading too much into that. It could have been, for all we know.
It could very easily have been, but
I do like that they didn't make that payoff, though, because I kind of like what really appealed to me about this movie was so much stuff. So you were talking about the unexpected scene where, you know, where the guy goes to self-sacrifice, right?
Yeah.
I thought there was a lot of that in this. There were unexpected edits for me, like just unexpected cuts to random bizarre things. And there were things like that that don't pay off. That I like, because it kept me on my toes for pretty much the entire movie, wondering just at any moment anybody could get picked off in this. And half the time, I feel like they were killing off more characters than were actually on that island.
Oh,
I kept checking
100%.
The cast every 5 seconds to be like, wait, somebody died. Who was it? Who was it that just died? Everybody still seems to be here.
Oh, yeah. Like 30 people land on the island and 80 people die somehow.
exactly.
I have a question about my fugue state when I wasn't all there. Is there any point in the film where the indigenous people of Skull Island are anything more than window dressing?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Nope.
Because
not really.
That was an interesting choice to me, because it felt like the writers sat down and thought, okay, is there any way we can write the indigenous population of Skull Island that no one will get angry at us for? And they basically decided no. So they gave them like one or two scenes to like give them a look and a basically a way of life, and then they're like weirdly not involved in the conflict at all.
Yeah, they're just gone. Like they leave the village, and the two like elders or whoever have their solemn nod at John C. Reilly, and then it's just like, you're out.
Yeah.
The only proactive thing they actually ever do is surround the group at one point. But other than that, they just stand there and they never speak. So they do absolutely nothing other than just sit there and look at people.
Totally
John C. Reilly has some sort of bizarre nonverbal communication skills with them. But other than that, they basically do nothing. And I kind of like that, too. It was just one more oddity in a movie full of a lot of weird stuff.
Yeah. I don't know if it was so much an oddity as everyone involved is kind of like looking at a situation and backing slowly away from it.
Do you think so? I didn't get that sense.
I'm not criticizing them for it. I think it was probably a smart move. I just think that, like, I felt like they didn't think they could get away with John C. Reilly being the only person on the island, but they also didn't want to be accused of tokenizing those characters or like doing anything untoward with them. So they found like the path of least resistance and followed it.
Yeah.
They did make them kind of token, though. I mean, ultimately, they just do nothing. And so people could complain like, oh, look, you had all these people, these natives, and they contributed in no way. So it's only the white people. Well, they're not all white people, but it's only the Americans that essentially do anything. Well, they're not all Americans either. But
yeah, it does feel like a very safe, safe modern American production where you have this very calculatedly diverse cast, like probably a more diverse set of people than you would have had if a real 1970s government agency was picking people.
Did any did any part of this movie really feel 70s to you? I know they said it in the 70s, but I have a suspicion that was purely for visuals.
Well, no.
I think he wanted the jungle like that, and he wanted those old-fashioned helicopters. I can see him just picturing that in his head and saying, you know what, let's set it in the 70s, because that's just going to look really
cool.
Oh, no,
I mean, I think the Vietnam stuff is very much there on a thematic level. I mean, there's also the fact that they shelled out millions on that soundtrack.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But again, I think that was just for the, you know, that's not aesthetic, but it was basically candy. I don't think the characters really, they don't talk like they're from the 70s. They don't act, they don't really bring up anything else in the 70s. That stuff is kind of layered very thin on the top. But really, this doesn't feel like a 70s movie to me. It didn't feel like 70s people. They didn't really even, their haircuts weren't anything like that. Their clothes weren't anything really like that. It just didn't matter.
That's true. I mean, I haven't recently been back to the 1970s to talk to anyone, so I can't be sure about the authenticity. I know they don't talk like people from movies in the 70s, but
exactly.
But who knows if that was
what
accurate?
I'm going on too.
Yeah.
On the soundtrack, was I the only one who felt they went a little too overboard on just the constant 70s music montages?
Yes.
Because it's like after a while, it's just like we get it. Like. The Stones, yes, Stones were a huge thing. Take out like maybe two and you're golden. As it is, after a while, I just started rolling my eyes at it.
I mean, I would have appreciated some deeper cuts that I hadn't heard a million times on like.
Well, I just want them to make a Vietnam movie where in the scene where it's like, this is Vietnam, they play something other than the Stones.
Yeah,
because
no,
the Stones were big, but it's like people were listening to a lot of music back then.
Yeah, I wouldn't, you know, some Gene Clark or something would not have been unappreciated. But no, I mean, it worked fine for like, you know, not so much establishing it as a film set in the 70s, but more establishing it as a movie that's supposed to remind us of other movies set in the 70s.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, definitely.
And it was an overall tone. It used basically only lively music that everybody recognizes. Again, this goes with the whole popcorn flavor of the thing. It really is trying to appeal to a wide demographic, and most people know these songs. It's not trying to do anything subtle. There's nothing subtle in Kong Skull Island. So them using, you know, music that nobody, you know, that fewer people listen to just wouldn't make sense for this.
I guess. I'm sort of thinking in the near middle distance about wrapping up, but like, is anyone else really confused as to how they're going to like handle the tone when King Kong meets Godzilla? Because
like, it's a crapshoot. Like, who knows how they're gonna do it?
They're so vastly different. Now, Godzilla had a sarcastic script. There was way too many characters cracking wise in that movie. But then it had a super serious monster tone to it.
Yeah.
The
writers and directors for, I think, the crossover, or no, it's the next Godzilla movie. It's going to be the same writers and directors who did that last Krampus movie. Did either of you see that one?
No.
Yeah.
Like, really, like, fun movie. Really fun movie. But, like, very, very, very tongue-in-cheek. So, like, I have no idea what the tone is going to be going forward.
Well, to be honest, like, do you really want to be the guys who make the super somber monster versus other monster movie?
Oh, like, absolutely not. I want to have fun. That's why I like this movie way more than the last Godzilla movie, because this one is having fun with itself and not trying to, you know, be way more serious than it should be.
Right.
I also kind of like that even though this is part of the whole Monsterverse thing, there really wasn't a lot of setup. They didn't leave it. There was no cliffhanger ending. This wasn't like a Marvel movie where they're just basically transitioning you into the next movie.
This could stand.
Yeah. It could stand as its own movie, even if there was never anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you'd probably forget about it 3 weeks later, but.
Oh, sure. But that's the kind of movie it is. Like, you forget about, you know, a lot of entertainment. This was just whiz bang like, jizz, fun. Essentially, of entertainment. You forget about that. But it's fun while it lasts.
Whiz bang, what?
You heard him.
Anyway, I guess any last thoughts, Thomas, on Skull Island and its place in the Kong mythos? Like, how would you rank it in terms of the Kong movies?
I mean, obviously, the thing I realized watching all of the Kong movies is you can't compare any of them to the original. It's just not going to happen. The original is so singular and so influential that basically there's that one and then there's everything else. It's certainly less weird than the 70s and 80s ones. It's not as triumphantly goofy as the two Japanese films, although it's certainly close. And it's certainly closer to those two in terms of tone and intent. It's less indulgent than the Peter Jackson movie, which is just 3 solid hours of I love King Kong so much. Like, just every single chance that that movie had to make a scene big and awesome and epic and overblown, it took it. So it's hard to say where it fits in with the rankings because it's on a very different wavelength than any of the others. I think as a movie in its own right, divorced from, you know, what it's trying to be a remake of or, you know, what other movies it's trying to compete with, it probably stands the best on its own of any of the ones since the original.
Yeah, I'd be with you there too. I think it's the best Kong since the original. It takes it off in a completely different direction than a lot of the, especially the American made Kongs. Did. So I liked that. I liked that it didn't try to
heart surgery.
Right. Well, that could have been interesting though. I really want to see King Kong Lives now.
It's weirdly hard to find too. That's the one thing.
But yeah, I think they didn't try to pay homage. The Peter Jackson one is just intolerable. I can't sit through that movie ever again. I will never watch it. There's nothing for me there. It's way too self-important.
Yeah.
I'm glad they didn't take that. I'm glad they didn't take a serious tone. Like I said, for me, this is a sort of a palate cleanse on King Kong, and I'm looking forward to seeing if they can continue this tone. I'd like to see where they can go next. I don't see any reason for now to go back to a serious movie like the 1933 version. I think it would be very, very hard to pull that off now, because back then the special effects played such a huge part, and we're not in awe of those anymore, and so we can't be as moved by them as people.
I mean, I think to get away with it now, you'd almost have to try to make, you'd have to try to dial up the intensity so far that you'd almost need to try to make it a horror film or like a really intense disaster film. And that doesn't seem like a great fit.
Well, like, do you remember the first trailer for the last Godzilla movie where it's like set to Thus Spoke Zarathustra or something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
They have the Oppenheimer quote. And then, of course, the movie we got was almost nothing like that. Maybe if they tried to make the movie that trailer was teasing, that might work, but otherwise, just go with this movie's
lead. I kind of feel like the 2000 Godzilla almost tried to do that.
The Roland Emmerich one?
Yeah.
Oh my god, I can barely remember that movie other than some eggs and Matthew Broderick.
And all the French guys named Jean something.
Yeah. Anyway, in conclusion, I think as far as ranking movies about giant monkeys that are also arguments for how history bends towards communism, I think that Kong Skull Island is among the best.
Big fish in a small pond, but yeah.
Yeah. No,
I'm going to give you the communist argument in this movie over John Wick. I see it way more here than I did in that.
All movies are about communism. I swear to God. Anyway, the movie's called Kong Skull Island. For once, we all enjoyed it. Hooray. Thomas, are you on the Twitters?
I am on the Twitters. I am Tom Types Words on Twitter.
Really? That's a good one.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm surprised it wasn't taken.
Oh. I am at Hollow Minds, which is a dumb anagram of my name. Patrick is not on Twitter because I'm not sure why. That's where all the...
he's sane. That's why.
I'm barely on Twitter. I have a semblance of a presence there. I run Goomba Stomp's N-Express podcast.
That's Twitter. Right, yes. I just meant you didn't have a personal Twitter.
I do, but I never use it. I haven't used it in like a year or something. It was hey, anybody out there, you know what? Ping me or something, whatever they do.
We demand to know what you had for breakfast.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you everyone for listening.
Well, if you look at that, it bleeds. We did that. We hook up with Chapman. There's enough munitions on that down sea stallion to finish the job.
Magnificent.
Isn't
Know why I carry this instead of an M16? Took it off a farmer fighting for the NVA. He surrendered right after we leveled his village. He was 50 years old, said he never even seen a gun until we showed up. Sometimes an enemy doesn't exist till you go looking for one.
What happens when they show up on your doorstep?
I'll still have his gun.
Best of luck with that, soldier.
Kamosame Kong! He lived in the jungle where he was born the king. His great strength made him lord of everything. No creature crossed his path and lived for long. His name, so legend tells us, was King Kong. His height was never measured, but was great. The jungle shook beneath his mighty weight. His arms were muscled, sturdy as a tree. His chest was thick and wide as it could be. Come on, Charlie. Sneak attack. They fought. First Kong went down, then up again.